This week on Unforgotten.
My name is Kathy Nellums. I'm the sister of Eric Nellums.
I'm Vincent Johnson. Eric was my uncle.
Hi, I'm Takia, and Eric was my uncle as well.
Anybody that needed help, he was there for them. He was a peaceful person. He wasn't a street guy.
You know, they killed him outside of his house. So, you know, that's just, it just hits hard. When
called my cousin and said, hey, you guys might want to get over here. Something's going on at your cousin's house. So that's how my family found out.
They didn't take anything from him. He had money, he had a nice truck, he had a home. They didn't go in the home.
I'm going to see my son laying there. And I wasn't allowed to touch him or anything. Just standing there.
Because he was such a powerful spirit. Now that he's gone, we miss him greatly.
Hey everyone, this is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten,
where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
And now for episode 36, Eric Nellums. Hey everyone, welcome back. I hope everyone is doing well out there. Before we get started on today's case, I just wanted to share a couple of things with all of you awesome and supportive listeners out there. You guys are really wonderful and very appreciated, as always. So first, you may have noticed a little bit of absence in the team if you've listened to our last episode about autism awareness and acceptance. Even though we didn't mention anything since we reshared the episode for Jason Sims Jr.'s that Sellers and I did together, Sellers has been taking a short leave. So you get to spend a little more one-on-one time with me as I share this next unforgotten case. We appreciate and thank you for continuing to support us in the cases which we're hoping to bring some much-needed attention to. There seems to have been a lot going on in the true crime world in the last few weeks, and I won't go through all of what we've seen, obviously, but I thought I'd mention just a couple of them. One case was, frankly, a bit brazen to me. It was the April 11th disappearance of Nikita Davidson from Birmingham, who was eventually located deceased on the 12th. Her boyfriend was bold enough to run into her car, then get out of the car and shoot her before loading her into the trunk of her own car and then driving away, leaving his car behind. Now, I have a hard time believing that he thought he was going to get away with that. I don't think he, you know, obviously he eluded them for a short time, but I don't know. Anyway, the family stated in the media that she was actually trying to leave him that night, but was unable to do so before he took her life. He was ID'd very soon after the murder, and it wasn't really shared in the media that who it was at first. But eventually they did say who they were looking for and located Nikita shortly after. It's really sad because not only was she trying to leave him, but she also left behind four children. That's a really sad case. Anyway, I hope that everything went well with that investigation so that they can put him behind bars for a long time. Before I share this next case, and even though we give a warning about sensitive content, I wanted to give you just an additional warning that the information on this case is really disturbing. It's involving a beautiful 5-year-old girl. And I'm not going to give any specific details about what happened, and we'll try to be as light on the detail of the charges as well. But the charges and sentence will speak for themselves, I think. We understand if you want to skip forward just a couple minutes, and then we'll be back on track. Sentencing occurred in Russell County Court just today, April 15th, as I'm editing this episode. In an appalling case of child abuse and murder, Jeremy Williams, who pleaded guilty to expedite the process, and probably the only saving grace of this case, was sentenced to death for the kidnapping and six-hour abuse and murder of Kamari Holland from Columbus, Georgia. Kamari is his girlfriend's five-year-old daughter. More specifically, he received four death sentences on four counts of capital murder. Murder during a kidnapping, as she was taken from Bowman Street in Columbus and ultimately found in an abandoned home in Phoenix City, Alabama. Murder for a child under 14. Murder with a rape and of first-degree sodomy. But that's not all. He received a life sentence for knowingly recording these acts. Another life sentence for human trafficking. 20 additional years for conspiracy to commit human trafficking, and another 10 years for the manner in which he treated her after death. As I said, just listening to all of that pretty much tells a story, and they really threw everything at him, it looks like, when they sentenced him. And usually when, you know, somebody pleads guilty, there's some sort of plea, you know, agreement, like they don't get the death penalty if they plead guilty. But in this case, that didn't happen. The trafficking probably has you thinking, well, it's the twist on this if you haven't followed the case. The girlfriend we spoke of, Christy Sipple, or Sipple, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, aka Christy Hoskins, Kamari's mother, was also arrested. Originally charged with felony murder, apparently she took a plea deal by pleading guilty to sex trafficking for selling Kamari to Williams for specific acts for $1,500. And I think, if I remember right, I read in the article that she actually was supposed to be $2,500 and he negotiated her down to $1,500. Anyway, she never actually even received that money. So actually, she sold her to him for $0. Zero. That means that though she was a commodity, apparently, to this mom and to Williams to start with, this mother gave no value of the life of her daughter. Anyway, she awaits sentencing, and there's just so much to this case and many reports in the media to give you further information. So I just wanted to mention that you can go look online or probably the local newspapers. The whole thing just makes me ill. Okay, my last bit here, I guess, is just an appropriate segue. I just wanted to share a reminder that April is also Child Abuse Prevention Month. This is important year-round, of course, but please help share this awareness if you are in social media or by word of mouth. If you like to, in a visual way, the symbol for this cause is the blue pinwheel. It's great to see the businesses out there and even private homes showing their solidarity by placing these on their property. It's beautiful, but also staggering when you catch a business who place one for every case in their community. I recently drove by our local library and made a point of doing so because every year they do just that. It puts a lump in my throat every time. I will include some child abuse prevention resource links in the episode detail for those who would like to learn more, you know someone that needs help, or just to raise awareness in your own way. All right, let's turn the page and head to the same city that we were just talking about where poor little Kamari was found, Phoenix City, Alabama, in Russell County. A small bit of interesting and mostly useless trivia. Those who live in Alabama or are very familiar with the area know that Alabama is in the central time zone. However, because of its location and proximity to Columbus, Georgia, where Kamari was taken from, Phoenix City is actually in Eastern time zone. I just found that kind of interesting as there are so many weird little idiosyncrasies about the cities in Alabama's history that we've been learning during our research of the cases. Phoenix City has had a long reputation for being a town of crime, being home to a crime syndicate and a seedy underbelly in the 1940s and 50s. It was actually known in the 50s as the wickedest city in America, according to an article in AL.com. There's even a movie that came out in 1955 called The Phoenix City Story, which is about the lawyer Albert Patterson, who joined a reform group trying to clean up the city. The movie's novelty, especially for the time it was created, was a 15-minute preface showing news footage and interviews of the background and events. I have this on my watch list now. Even though it's a 1955 movie, it seems to have been kind of unique for a movie back then. Anyway, the negative reputation seemed to stick. In looking up its data, keeping in mind that we've discussed the varied inaccurate reporting of crime statistics in past episodes, per capita, Phoenix City is not that far below the violent crime rate of Mobile. But we know that there are beautiful and interesting areas of every city, filled with many wonderful families and small businesses. And often, these cities have a neighboring city that would be nearly as one with the other. Such is the case with Phoenix City and Columbus, Georgia, who were only separated by a bridge, but otherwise feel like one city. One of these wonderful families belongs to Eric Nellums, who is the focus today. We were able to talk to Eric's sister, Kathy Nellums, his niece, Takia, and nephew, Vincent, and they will help share Eric's life and tragic story throughout the episode.
My name is Kathy Nellums. I'm the sister of Eric Nellums and primary advocate.
I'm Vincent Johnson. Eric was my uncle.
Hi, I'm Takia, and Eric was my uncle as well.
Eric Nellums was born in 1971 in Columbus, Georgia, to Annie and Ernest. And as I mentioned, to be from Columbus was just like being from Phoenix City. And being from Phoenix City was just like being from Columbus.
And you are all in the Atlanta area, right, in Georgia?
Yes.
Yeah. And mom, Annie.
Annie Whittlesey.
Thank you. Mom is where?
She's in Columbus.
Okay.
Eric was from a large family with 8 sisters and 6 brothers. And I have to take a deep breath there. My, that's a lot of children. I did have a friend growing up who had almost as many in their family. And it's really fun to be around a family that's that large, actually. I just have a brother and a sister, which is probably a handful for a lot of people just to have the 3. But wow, I mean, 15 kids. Wow. Here's Kathy to share a bit about her brother growing up.
So my brother was short in stature, but big in real life. So he played baseball. He started off, you know, in the local parks playing baseball, and everybody used to say, oh, he's so little. But yet when he went out on the field, he would knock it out the park. And then they would be like, oh, look at him. So like my children stated, my brother was very nice, mild-mannered, considerate, charismatic, and friendly. So he was very popular, and he started off in a youth league playing, you know, baseball, and then on into high school. He also played for our high school, which is Carver High School in Columbus, Georgia. And, you know, everybody, he was just so popular, and I was older than him, but people used to always say, oh, that's Kathy's, that's Eric's little sister, but I was the big sister. But because he was so popular, they saw me as the younger one, and, you know, he was that guy. So just having those memory, and when he also was the trainer for the football team, and just thinking about all these guys are towering above him, but yet he's the center of attraction because he's just that type of person, and the football players loved him, and just everybody loved him because he was just that guy.
So as you can tell, Eric was loved tremendously, and he was the type of person who would do anything for his family and friends. Takia and Vincent shared a bit about Eric as well and who he was to them.
So, who my uncle was to me, he was just like a kind-hearted, charismatic, just all in for family type of guy. But yeah, he was just a great guy. He just always, looked out for my mom, his mom. He was always there. He was just like a good man. That's all.
So for me, my uncle was a lot. As a child, he was a father figure. But even me being that young, I could always see him doing things for other people. He would do things for my mom. He would do things for his friends, his mom. Anybody that needed help, he was there for them. He also was a very caring guy. I never seen him yell at anyone. I never seen him in an altercation. He was a peaceful person. He wasn't a street guy. Family. He was the type of person that would help us congregate, whether it was a barbecue or him having a fight party, whatever it was, he kind of brought the family together.
Eric dated a childhood friend, Tara, who goes by the name Molly, when he attended Carver High School in Columbus. When he graduated, they split up, and in October of 1990, he joined the Army Airborne, becoming a private second class Red Beret until December of 1992.
He served in Germany. He went to Fort Linwood and then eventually to, well, he went to Fort Benning and then to Fort Campbell in Kentucky. So he got a lot of rewards. They called him Sharpshooter because when it was time for him to do his, I don't know what they call them, marksman test, he exceeded their expectations. So
while serving in Germany, he was also deployed to the Persian Gulf during the Gulf War. He and Molly would see each other sometimes when he was on leave, but she and he both got married to other people. They also both eventually got divorced, and Kathy explains a little bit about this.
Her family moved to an area where my family lived, and because we had a mutual cousin, we all kind of played together and hung out in the Phoenix City. So they dated throughout high school, and then my brother went to the Army, and when he went to the Army, they kind of separated, and they would get back together when he would come home from leave. But during that time, she had a child by somebody else and also got married. So he also went on with his life and got married and had a child. Eventually, he got a divorce. They would continue to date off and on throughout life and eventually just decided that they were going to be together and marry.
So Eric and Molly were married on April 29th of 2003. Now, this date was mentioned by her in a newspaper clip that Molly actually posted on the anniversary a couple years after his death. So because of the date of the article, I'm going to assume it was the 29th, but it was at least close to that date that they were married. We haven't been able to find a marriage certificate or anything yet, but I'm pretty sure that that would have been the date or close to the date. They also bought a house around the same time. He was employed with Kodak Polychrome, and Molly had her two children, Shantavius and Dartavius, with them, whom he actually treated like his own children. And I hope I didn't butcher their names. I think that's how you pronounce them. And though his son Antonio lived in Kentucky with his mother Sheila, he would see his son often.
He's ex-military. He worked hard. He was a hard-working man and a very diligent father. He never wavered. His son lived in Kentucky. He lived in Georgia or Alabama. He always would go see him. Sometimes I would travel with him. And he always was the best father that he could be, even from a distance. He treated their kids as his own, and he gave them the world. He wasn't the type of person that just cut you off. Even if that relationship dissolved, he was always around.
Though I'm sure Eric wouldn't say his life was perfect, he did seem to be laying ground for a good life and was the responsible husband and father and overall family man. But unfortunately, only about 6 months from when he started his new life with Molly and her kids, a completely unforeseen, unbelievable tragedy happened that would prevent his future with his family and kids from being realized.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Friday, September 26, 2003, was a seemingly normal, dry September morning. It was already working up towards 70 degrees when Eric arose to get ready for work at Kodak Polychrome. 5:20 a.m. is the time that he would normally leave his home, which is located in the new neighborhood at the end of a cul-de-sac, which is off another side street in this new community. And right on course with his normal routine, he walked out of his home to get into his truck, which is parked under his carport, getting ready for a 25-minute or so drive. Molly would then hear noises that would change her and her children's and Eric's family's lives.
When my brother went outside to crank up his truck to go to work, that she heard gunshots. When she heard the gunshots, she said she went out of her room and gathered her kids from two different rooms. Her daughter, who was older, and her son, who was maybe 3-4 at that time. She gathered them, went back into their bedroom, which is on the back side of the house. Then she pushed something, we call them shift rows, but some people call them like wards, but they're really tall, kind of dresser-like things. She said she pushed it up against the door and then pushed out the screen, put the kids outside of the window, and then she jumped out. She said once she felt it was okay, she went and knocked on the neighbor's door and told him to call 911.
From my perspective, I was a kid, but I was at school. And my mom came and picked me up and she said, we have to go home. Home is Columbus, granny's house. And on the way there, she was trying to call him, you know, call Eric. And she kept calling. He wasn't answering the phone. And we were on the way down there. It was just, I don't remember any music being on or anything like that. And it was like the longest trip to Columbus I've ever had. And I just remember getting to Columbus and turning on my grandmother's street, East Wind Lane, and not seeing his truck. His truck would be there. Everybody else was there. His truck, like that green Dodge, would be in the grass, you know, and it wasn't. And it was just like this feeling of, you know, something's wrong. And we get into the house and, you know, they tell us what happened. And just anger and confusion rushes over you because you don't understand. It doesn't feel real. You're just confused and hurt and crying. And at that point, you know, everybody kind of just congregated together, but nobody had answers. And it didn't make sense because, like I said before, he wasn't a street person. He wasn't a violent dude. Never seen him in an argument. So it didn't make sense.
Yeah, I would say even being young, like at 11 years old when it happened, I just remember being, my brother and my mom used to call me Room Raider. I just remember going through my mom's information and paperwork just to see like, what type of information can I get on this case? Or, you know, what more can I learn? Yeah, we didn't understand completely, but we had a grasp that we, you know, we lost somebody close to us and someone close to him had to take him because, you know, they killed him outside of his house. So, you know, that's just, it just hits hard when you hear something like that. So as a little girl, I was 11, but I really, you know, I think I really understood what happened.
From reports, Eric had been ambushed and shot. We aren't sure and don't have a police incident report. But from the autopsy, there were matching bullets recovered from his body. And I won't go into any detail here as it's not necessary, but it's evident from the location that he was found at his home and the number of critical shots fired, this really seemed targeted, in my opinion, and Eric stood little to no chance of surviving. His family agrees that this felt targeted and not random, which would leave them to believe that it was surely someone Eric knew, and possibly that some of his family members may know as well.
So, like I said earlier, the feeling of somebody that's capable of this being amongst you and your family is scary. And we've been trying to figure it out since. And no real leads or clues or anything. Some rumors here and there, but nothing solid enough to act on. But I just remember not feeling real and being upset that we didn't know what happened. And the part the anger comes from, they didn't take anything from him. He had money, he had a nice truck, he had a home. He didn't go in the home. It's just complete malice. There was some intent there, and it wasn't to rob him. It was to take him away for some reason. And that's the part where the anger builds up in. And the part the anger comes from, they didn't take anything from him. He had money, he had a nice truck, he had a home. He didn't go in the home. It's just complete malice. There was some intent there, and it wasn't to rob him. It was to take him away for some reason. And that's the part where the anger builds up in.
But I feel like the location was intentional, simply because Phoenix City is so small, and normally he would get on a highway to go to work, and in less than 5 minutes he would have crossed the Georgia line, which, you know, Columbus Police Department has more resources. And so, again, that's why I think that the location of the homicide was strategic.
What unfolded, as far as everyone learning what happened, was not routine. They heard from cousins to come over to the house because something happened.
And somebody that knew my cousin lived like in that subdivision and called my cousin and said, hey, you guys might want to get over here. Something's going on at your cousin's house. So that's how my family found out that my brother had been shot. I wasn't there. I was in Atlanta. So I really felt like I was the last person to know. And that kind of weighs on me a lot, too. But not that I could have made a difference, but yeah.
There never seemed to be much in the way of leads, or at least Vanellum's family never really got much information. In fact, the police department didn't even contact them right away after the incident happened.
From the very beginning, Phoenix City Police did not reach out to us day one, day two, day three. It happened on a Friday. They didn't contact us on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I reached out to them on the very first day. And on Monday, I called again until I got to speak with somebody. But I just thought that as a common courtesy, the least you could do, although my mom was on the scene, is you can reach out and say, hey, I just want to follow up with you just to make sure everything's okay. Or is there any questions you have? None of that happened.
Really giving the police department the benefit of the doubt that they did investigate to start with. Still, there has been little to no communication or information provided to Annie, Kathy, or any of the family. At the time we did our interview, Kathy shared that they were reaching out to the Attorney General's cold case unit to plead for them to take on the case. Whether the police department interfered and refused to cooperate, or whether the AG made the decision, the Phoenix Police Department stated they've exhausted all leads and the case will remain in their jurisdiction. Because of this, in March, Kathy created a petition directed at the AG office to try once again to get them to reopen and take Eric's case. They are doing so on behalf of Eric first and foremost, of course, but they feel just as strongly that this sends a message that every life matters and no case should be left forgotten or ignored. We'll include the petition in our details. If you haven't signed yet, we encourage you to do so and hope you will share with others. On June 18th in 2004, Governor Bob Riley issued a reward proclamation offering a $5,000 reward for the information leading to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrator or perpetrators. The proclamation expired at some point, so Governor Kay Ivey reissued this same proclamation on December 12th of 2023 this last year. Also in December of 2023, Crime Stoppers increased their original $1,000 reward to $5,000. So this brings the reward total to $10,000.
The sadness in not having the answers on his murder, it's still like a lingering cloud. There's no closure there. And it's an eerie feeling because we're from a small town. Columbus is right next to Phoenix City, as you guys know. It's a small town and kind of everybody knows everybody town. And to think that there's somebody in your midst that's capable of doing that and could possibly be still smiling in your face to this day is scary. And that should be rectified. He deserves for his killer to be exposed and judged, prosecuted, and put away. He deserves that. Our family, his son.
This has been rough on the whole family, each coping in their own ways. Eric's son, Antonio, wanted to be named Eric Jr. after his father's death. And frankly, that's what Kathy has programmed in her phone as its contact name, which I love. Vincent mentioned that Antonio is more like a brother than a cousin, especially growing up. They were fairly close in age and they were around each other as much as they could with him living back in Kentucky when they were kids. And now, as an adult, Antonio has a beautiful daughter. I saw a picture and she is just such a cutie. Antonio followed in his father's footsteps and he entered the military.
So he had a lot of certificates and awards and medals. And after his death, it was at his home. But after his death, that was some of the things that I made sure I got from his home, from his wife at the time, and kept that because I felt like it was really sacred. And his son admired him and followed his footsteps and also went into the Army. So he now is excelling as well. He just recently made sergeant. And I pass those memories or mementos on to him so that he can kind of see what his dad did and kind of use that for inspiration. And I feel honored to give those things to him. He's following his footsteps. As a matter of fact, he's exceeding it by recently making a sergeant. So I'm very proud of Eric's son. His name is Antonio Nellums, and he also has a granddaughter. Her name is Araya Nellums. And like my son stated, it would have been great just to see him be a father and a grandfather, because that little girl, she's so precious. And, you know, every time I look at her, I just embrace her and hold her because she's a part of him. So
recently, Antonio sent a message to Kathy so that she could share it with us about where he is with his father's death now, and his wish not to be public any more than to say the following. I love that y'all have the motive to get his case solved, but honestly, I have no interest in doing a podcast or interview. What happened 20 years ago is still stuck with me, but it has made me the man I am today. Life could have been different with him here for sure, but his presence/spirit is always with me. I used to want his case solved. Part of me still does, and ask whoever did it why. But I don't want to get my mind going into the dark all over again, bringing all that depression and hatred in my life. I just want to live a life where my child gets to see her father at her biggest moments in life growing up. And I think this is really important to, you know, I'm glad that he sent that, because a lot of times we don't realize just how much we assume that family wants to be involved sometimes in true crime. I think everybody just assumes that they want to be out there doing what we're all doing. And if we want to share a story, you know, that they will want to be involved in that way. But a lot of these families have a lot of pain that they just don't want to share with the general public. It's private for them, or it's too hurtful for them. And this is so important to respect that. So to Antonio, I totally understand we would never assume that you would want to like be involved in all of the public part of this. We are so sorry that you didn't have your father growing up, and we'll leave it at that. Eric and Kathy's mom, Annie, couldn't be with us at the interview, but we asked her permission to use a clip or two from a news video from WAKA Channel 8. It really brings home how much it takes from a family, a mother, to lose her son. My heart goes out to Annie, and we thank her for being brave to share her feelings with all who will listen on that interview.
I still sometimes see flashbacks. I'm seeing my son laying there on the ground with bullets in his head. And I wasn't allowed to touch him or anything. Just standing there. My heart is still broken. I just don't know. I just have to trust in the Lord to keep me and give me strength to go on.
We asked Kathy, Takiya, and Vincent if they had anything they would like to say to Eric's murderer or anyone with information that they aren't sharing.
Of course, I would want to know why, but I would just ask them, after all this time, does it feel like it was worth it? Does it feel like it was worth it? Because they're around, so they see, they talk to people, people know. Was it worth it?
Well, it's been 20 years, so if anybody was afraid then, I would think they'll be more relaxed now. And, you know, I want somebody to come forward, you know. And it's I would hope that somebody would come forward and do what's right. And you know, there's a lot of evil that's going on in this world. And I just hope that I still believe in the goodness of people. And I hope that somebody will hear something that, you know, touches their heart and say, hey, let me go ahead and call in this tip. It can be small. You know, sometimes it takes the smallest clue to clear these cases, but just call it in so it can be investigated and see what happens.
I want to close with some positive memories and thoughts shared during our visit. It's so important to remember that these cases are not just cases and that these special people left loved ones behind with only memories. We hope that this reminds everyone, not just our caring listeners, but those with information, or even more so, if the person who took Eric away from his family is listening, that Eric was a wonderful man and deserves to have peace, and his family deserves answers and hopefully a bit of justice.
Yeah, the first time I remember, we went to a water park. It was me, my brother, and my uncle's wife's two kids, which are, you know, because my uncle's wife's two kids and his son as well. So it was like five of us. And it was just like a really fun day. We enjoyed the water park. We listened to music, just had a really good time. And that's like really like the last fond memory I have of him.
I think about him every day, but the memory I have of him, my favorite, was at his wedding, during his wedding reception. And he was just happy. He was happy, he was dancing. And I don't think I ever seen him smile that much, you know? And I think about it all the time, almost on a daily basis.
I'm not saying he's great just because he's my brother. If he was something opposite of that, I would be transparent and say that. But he was not in the streets. He was not doing anything to anybody until the day he died. Just really didn't think that he had enemies because he was so loved. And when they had his funeral, it was packed. And I looked for a second. I was like, wow, are all these people here for my brother? And the detective said it was over 300 people there. So that kind of is a test to how much he was loved and how people just, you know, cared about him and how he cared back. So that's my favorite memory. Yes.
Thank you for being here with the Nelums family. Please share his story and please sign his petition if you haven't already.
I appreciate what you guys do, you know, not just for my family, but for all families, because I'm just so passionate about this, and I feel for everybody that has to deal with this, because it's really been devastating. Even after all these years, it's still, like, I can cry at a drop of a dime just talking about it. So thank you guys again for what you do.
If you have any information regarding the murder of Eric Nellums, no matter how small or unimportant you think it may be, please call Central Alabama Crime Stoppers at 334-215-7867 or 215-STOP. You can also submit tips online. These are completely anonymous avenues if you wish not to leave your name or any personal information. As always, you can reach us at info@alcoldcase.com or on our website. And we'll have all the contact information in our episode description, as usual.
The biggest part of this is the void that's left behind from his presence, because he was such a powerful spirit. Now that he's gone, we miss him greatly.
Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast, to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Spotify for Podcasters, available on your favorite podcast platform. Intro music for the show was created by Principles of Uncertainty, who also mixed and mastered this episode. Content and production is by Sellers and Stormy. Artwork by Sellers. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and any source referenced in our podcast can be found in each episode's description. We hope you will join us on all the major social media sites and continue to raise awareness of our Alabama cold cases. Until next time, thank you for listening, and remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.